welcome to the Sasson edition of the St Albans and District Talking News for the week of the 16th of May 2026. My name is Molly and I produce and edit this programme. And we've kicked off with Aretha Franklin's rallying feminist cry for respect, or she says it, R-E-S-P-C-T, as our opening track. And there's a very good reason, as I am especially excited this week to bring you an exclusive interview with Jill Burridge, who served as the editor of Radio 4's Woman's Hour for over a decade. During the conversation with Rob, Jill shares her insights into the experience of producing such an iconic show and reflects on working alongside the late and much-respected Jenny Murray. And that, dear listeners, sets the tone for this week's programme. Throughout the show, we will be focusing on all things female and featuring an historic account of women's struggle for emancipation, some poetry and music that exemplify what it is to be a woman. And I make no apologies to our gentlemen listeners, as we have been listening to you for centuries. But of course, I'm joking. I hope everyone enjoys this show equally. Also this week, our audiobook review is Heartburn by Nora Ephron. And Charlotte is back with her latest update from the Buddy Dog series. Blind Baker Penny shares her recipe for stuffed peppers. And of course, we will have all our usual features, including birthdays and events from this week in history, the audio described TV and radio programmes for the coming week. And for those of you listening via the USB pen drives, the BBC's In Touch podcast. But first, we have all the local news courtesy of the Hearts Advertiser and the St Albans Times, read by Catherine, Karen, Margaret, Alison and Ian.
News from the Hearts Advertiser. My name is Ian Chisholm, teacher barred for assault and drink driving, taught at JFK and Watling View. A former assistant head teacher at St Albans Special School has been barred indefinitely from the profession for drink driving and omitting a previous assault to their employer. Mark Chalcroft, 55, was teaching at John F. Kennedy School and later at Watling View School when the incident took place in 2008 and 2019. A Teaching Regulation Agency, TRA, misconduct panel met in March 2026 and decided to ban him from the profession indefinitely. On February 22, 2019, Chalcroft was convicted of driving a motor vehicle with excess alcohol. He did not disclose this to his employer at Watling View until several weeks later. His disclosure arose during a telephone conversation in which his employer asked him whether he needed to disclose anything after they had already been notified of the conviction, a report by the TRA read. The panel heard this was not his first omission of a previous conviction while he worked there. Chalcroft taught at John F. Kennedy School in London between September 2000 until February 2016. During his time at John F. Kennedy School, on October 18, 2008, Chalcroft pulled an individual, brackets person A, who was holding a child, causing them, brackets person A, to fall backwards. He accepted a police caution for a common assault at the time. Chalcroft applied for a new role at Watling View School. In 2018, Chalcroft was asked to complete a staff suitability declaration which asked him whether he had received any cautions or convictions either before or during his employment at Watling View School. Chalcroft answered no to this question, the panel heard. The report alleged that while employed at Watling View School, he failed to disclose his conviction either promptly or at all and told the school he accepted the aforementioned police caution for grabbing a burglar or words to that effect, which was not the case. In this case, I have placed considerable weight on the fact that the panel has found several instances of serious misconduct taking place over a number of years, the report continued. I have also noted that while there were some mitigating circumstances present, the panel has found that Mr. Chalcroft's actions were both deliberate and committed free of duress. I have also placed considerable weight on the seriousness of Mr. Chalcroft's misconduct, which includes being convicted of driving with excess alcohol, accepting a police caution for common assault and dishonesty, as well as the evidence that he has yet to develop full insight into his actions. In making their decision, the panel recognised his good teaching record and a long and otherwise unblemished career. The report added, "While the misconduct found by the panel in this case included violence and dishonesty, I have noted its comments regarding Mr. Chalcroft's remorse as well as his otherwise good record over the course of his career. I have also given weight to its conclusion that the risk of repetition appears to be low. As regards the conviction, he stated that he deeply regretted how the school found out and that as an advisory teacher he needs to make amends. Mr. Chalcroft stated that for him, teaching is more than a career." A spokesperson for Watling View School told the paper, "We expect the highest standards of honesty and integrity from all of our staff. When it came to our attention that Mr. Chalcroft had been convicted of an offence and had not disclosed this to us, his employment was terminated. We hope the conclusion of the hearing draws a line under the matter."
Hello, this is Catherine. St Albans Times. Crying out from St Albans, city's links to Salvation Army newspaper. Take a walk, cycle or run along the Alban Way and you'll come across a curious halt or stop on the disused railway line linking St Albans with Hatfield. Called simply Salvation Army, it's a local link with a publishing phenomenon that today spans 130 countries around the world and is still a common sight on many high streets around Britain. From 1901 to 1991, the Salvation Army-owned Campfield Press in St Albans printed the Christian organisation's War Cry, a weekly newspaper launched in 1879 when Queen Victoria sat on the throne and Benjamin Disraeli was Prime Minister. Nearly 150 years later, it's still going strong. The stop on the line, visible on today's Alban Way, helped speed the War Cry and other Salvation Army publications on trains across the country. The halt and sidings continued in use until 1964. At its peak, the Campfield Press employed more than 350 people at its Campfield Road plant. They worked on Salvation Army publications, including newspapers and hymn books, as well as commercial print work. One Campfield Press apprentice from the 1960s recalled, "The army gave us sound training. You didn't need to be a Salvationist to work there. In fact, few of the men were Salvationists. But whilst you were on the premises, you had to conform to army principles of no drinking, no smoking and no pin-ups on the press. And we all had to attend a weekly service." A message from Campfield's director, Colonel H.J. Wright, published in a brochure for potential customers, explained, "The welfare of employees is carefully observed in the knowledge that happy and contented workers are a source of mutual satisfaction and everything is done for the promotion of high moral and spiritual ideals." Fleetville developed as a centre for printing in the late 1800s as companies based in London's Fleet Street began to move to the city because they needed more space. One of the first exhibitions at the newly developed St Albans Museum and Gallery in 2018 featured the area's printing history. St Paul's Church on Hatfield Road was opened in 1910 to serve the growing area of Fleetville and today provides a range of community facilities in addition to being a thriving place of worship. We have an image here of an early edition of War Cry from March 1924. Today, the Salvation Army reports that the War Cry still reaches around 1.7 million readers in the UK and Ireland alone and raises around £1.6 million to support community projects. The writer is a fan of the publication and buys a copy every time they see it on sale from a Salvation Army member in London or on a local high street. The War Cries Long Life shows that printed publications still have a role to play in a digital world. Recent copies have featured Premier League club AFC Bournemouth explaining the meaning of the Bible verse on a player's badge, lessons in honesty from a new ITV spy drama, and a mother explaining why she chose to homeschool her children. Each edition also includes information about the Christian faith and how people can obtain more information. The Salvation Army began on the streets of East London in 1865, when Methodists William and Catherine Booth abandoned the traditional concept of a church pulpit to take God's word directly to the people. Today, it is a church and charity active in virtually every corner of the world, including St Albans and across Hertfordshire. It is currently serving in more than 130 countries, with many producing local variations of the war cry, a global phenomenon with deep connections to St Albans.
Hello, this is Alison. My first story is from the St Albans Times and has the headline, "A Touch of Barry Comes to Question of Sport." Members of the local business community gathered to support Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care at its annual Question of Sport fundraiser, collecting more than £76,000 for local hospice care. The event brought together teams from across the area for an evening of friendly competition and entertainment, with a sport-themed quiz hosted by former actor and presenter Sean Williamson, best known for his EastEnders character Barry Evans. A team from Gilbert's Chartered Accountants and Business Advisors was victorious in the quiz, which was attended by special guests from the world of sport, including footballers Luther Blissett, OBEDL, who is patron of Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care, as well as Helen Ward. Also boxing champion John Conti, MBE, as well as actor Colin Salmon. Lisa Meager, Head of Partnerships at Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care, said afterwards, "It was great to see the local business community out in force at our annual Question of Sport event. Behind the entertainment, lively quiz and friendly competition on the night is a serious cause, which is providing extraordinary care to people in our community whose lives have been turned upside down by a serious illness. The evening raised £76,450, which will make a huge difference to local people who need our care. This wouldn't have been possible without our event sponsors, including the headline sponsor, Graham and Sibbald, and everyone who bought a ticket, bid in the auction, and dug deep to support the raffle. I'd like to say a huge thank you to our host, Sean Williamson, and everybody who came on the night and made it a wonderful event."
Hello, Margaret Cox reading from St Albans Times. A city centre pub is set to close for good on Sunday. The Beach House in St Peter's Street has announced it will permanently close its doors after Sunday lunch. The pub was bought out by Upham Inns last July after former owners Oakman Inns went into administration. But today Upham revealed that the High Street hostelry would not be continuing to operate under their umbrella. A social media post said, "We would like to extend our heartfelt thanks to our incredible team and to all of our guests for your loyalty and support over the years. It has truly been a pleasure to welcome you." The Beach House opened in September 2014 on the former site of Veer Dara Indian Restaurant after that business was served with a notice of repossession by Pizza Hut, the former occupiers of the building and the leaseholders.
White Hart Tap to reopen after significant investment. A cosy and comforting St Albans pub is set to reopen following a significant investment. The White Hart Tap does have a future, despite concerns when its previous landlord left earlier this month. Steve McConnell had been running the tap since 1999, creating a solid band of regulars and offering a range of cask beers and food to the local community. After marking 28 years in charge, Steve's lease with the pub's operator Punch concluded and he pulled his final pint on Sunday, May 3rd. The White Hart Tap closed the same day. A spokesperson for Punch told the Hearts Advertiser, "The plan is to reopen the pub in the week commencing June the 8th, following a significant capital expenditure investment. The timings of the venue's relaunch are subject to change, but it is confirmed the Keyfield Terrace pub will show Sky and TNT Sports throughout the week, in addition to hosting quizzes and monthly entertainment. Currently, the tap has seen its signage removed and scaffolding erected around its exterior. South Hearts Camera wished the incoming tenant all the best, but cited concerns over the pub's future. A Facebook post by the branch read, "All the signs would suggest that owners Punch have a woeful ignorance of what have made this pub so great over the years and are about to make very retrograde changes to it. To Steve, we say a huge thank you for his service to local pubgoers over such a long period, and all the very best for whatever comes next."
The next story is from the St Albans Times and is entitled "Communities Urged to Back Vital Mental Health Initiative This May. Why We Should All Get Involved in Mental Health Awareness Week and Change Lives for the Better." As It's Okay to Say marks Mental Health Awareness Month this May, the St Albans-based charity is calling on members of the public and organisations to play an active role in supporting mental health well-being across the community. With Mental Health Awareness Week taking place next week, the campaign comes at a crucial time to highlight the importance of open conversations, early support and accessible care. The charity provides essential mental health support and helps individuals begin their journey to well-being as quickly and efficiently as possible. It offers a wide range of accessible resources, including therapeutic services, support groups, workshops and more, right in the heart of St Albans, as well as pop-ups in other locations and online. At the heart of the campaign is a powerful visual display, a collection of individual profiles, each represented by a number. Every profile symbolises a real person and a story, a reminder that mental health challenges can affect anyone, regardless of age, background or circumstance. Members of the public and organisations are invited to sponsor one of these profiles. The process is intentionally straightforward. Supporters simply choose a profile number from the image and email the charity to express their interest. From there, arrangements for sponsorship are made and sponsors are kept updated throughout the campaign, allowing them to follow the journey and impact of their contribution. Crucially, funds raised through each sponsorship go directly to the individual behind that chosen profile. This support can include one-to-one or family sessions with a qualified clinician, access to workshops, tailored resources, and ongoing support through peer groups and community networks. By linking donations directly to a person, the initiative ensures that help is both immediate and deeply personal. Stacey Turner, founder and CEO of the charity, said the initiative is designed to make giving more meaningful. "We want people to feel connected to the difference they're making. Each profile represents a life, a voice, and a reminder that no one should face mental health struggles alone." The appeal also comes as demand for mental health support continues to grow. It's Okay to Say plays a vital role in bridging gaps in services, particularly at a community level where the early intervention and connection can make a significant difference. The phone call when we call the recipient to share we've successfully achieved funding to support their journey is an emotional one and a favourite moment of mine, Stacey added. Organisations are being encouraged to get involved, not only through sponsorship, but also by promoting the campaign within their networks. By taking part, organisations have an opportunity to demonstrate their commitment to well-being and social responsibility, while helping to foster a more supportive environment for all. As Mental Health Awareness Week approaches, the message is clear. Small actions can have a big impact. Sponsoring a profile is more than just a donation. It's a direct investment in someone's well-being. a step towards reducing stigma and a way of ensuring that more people feel heard, supported and understood. To take part, email the charity at support@itsoktosay.org.uk or phone 01727 482 457.
New gelateria overwhelmed by support. Queues of customers have been forming at City's Italian eatery. An Italian eatery has been overwhelmed by the support of the St Albans community since its opening weekend. Offering gelato, coffee, focaccia and more, Dolce Vita launched on Friday, April 24th, with queues spilling out the door. The new spot lies next to the clock tower on French Row, where the interior has been transformed with retro Italian pop art and eccentric branding. A spokesperson for Dolce Vita said, "A taste of Italy has arrived in St Albans, bringing the spirit of La Dolce Vita with it. We are now open and are absolutely overwhelmed by the warm welcome. Warning, you may enter for one scoop and leave shouting Mamma Mia with three." Dolce Vita comes from the same team behind a popular restaurant named L'Antica Pizzeria in Hampstead. "We are now expanding our culinary vision with a focus on artisanal gelato," the spokesperson added. Dolce Vita opens between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. from Sunday to Friday and 9 a.m. until 7 p.m. on Saturdays. And there are pictures of the staff, a customer with his ice cream, pastries and outside seating.
The next story comes from the Hearts Advertiser and has the headline, "Man to appear in court on suspicion of Harpenden shop theft." The individual was arrested by PC Jem Oliver in Hay Lane on suspicion of shoplifting from Waitrose on May the 7th. PC's Jem Oliver and Iffy Iqbal were on patrol along Leighton Road with support from PCSO Perrin when they were flagged down by a member of staff in Waitrose. They detained a man in his 30s after food and household items were allegedly stolen from the store at around 3:15 p.m. He has since been charged and bailed but is soon due in court. The same PCs responded to a reported alcohol theft at Waitrose on Friday, May the 1st. Paul Sharp of Guildford Road, Luton, was arrested in connection with the incident after being identified as wanted by Bedfordshire Police. He was charged with the theft, alcohol, possession of Class A drugs and possession of an offensive weapon, a lock knife, and is due to appear in Stevenage Magistrates Court.
Harpenden family shares story after 92-year-old left tetraplegic. A Harpenden family is speaking out to challenge the perception that spinal cord injuries only affect younger people after a 92-year-old former BBC producer who once travelled the world covering royal tours was left tetraplegic following a sudden accident at home. Marking Spinal Cord Injury Awareness Day on May the 15th, Susan Kerr has shared her family's experience of navigating life after her husband, Michael, sustained a severe spinal cord injury in March 2019. "I heard this almighty thump and found him unconscious on the floor," recalls Susan. "That was the start of a long life lesson and a huge change in life for both of us. Michael, who was 85 at the accident, sustained a severe spinal cord injury, leaving him tetraplegic. After initial treatment, he was transferred to Stoke Mandeville Hospital, a move Susan now describes as critical. We were told, this is the Oxford and Cambridge of spinal injury care. You've got to go to Stoke," she says. "It's so important to get the right specialist care. The difference is huge." After 4 months of rehabilitation, Michael returned home, but arranging care proved overwhelming. "We were told he'd be coming home in a few weeks, and I had no idea how to arrange care, no help at all," Susan says. "You don't know what you don't know. There should be a how-to guide in every spinal hospital about arranging care, because there isn't. The couple initially explored agency live-in carers, dubbed personal assistants, PAs, but struggled with consistency. The idea is they help you live your life, not just look after you, Susan explains. But continuity is everything, and that's one of the hardest things to achieve. After a series of mixed experiences, Susan turned to St Albans-based home care provider Abbott's Care, a decision she says transformed their situation. They came up with the goods, she said. They are reliable, they're talkable, and we always knew they had our back. Always. As Michael's needs became more complex, Abbott's Care delivered a flexible package of live-in and overnight care, supporting everything from mobility and personal care to complex clinical routines. Camille Leopold, CEO of Abbott's Care, said, "Spinal injuries affect every aspect of daily life, from mobility to complex medical needs. The right care isn't just about practical support. It's about helping people feel in control again and live life on their own terms. Every spinal injury is different, which is why care has to be built around the individual, their routines, their goals, and what matters most to them. Our focus is always on empowering independence, dignity, and confidence for both the individual and their family." Earlier this year, after more than 6 years at home, Michael moved into a local care home, a transition supported by Abbott's Care, including help with handover and continuity. "Having someone Michael knew and trusted during that move made all the difference," Susan says. "They didn't just provide care. They supported us as a family." Reflecting on their journey, she adds, "Nothing about this is easy. Mind you, I was still in charge of contact with district nurses, GP, chemist, social services, and more. But having the right people around you makes all the difference." During his lifetime, Michael travelled the world as BBC producer, covering royal visits, joining the royal entourage on overseas tours to South America, the United States, Japan, and Russia. Susan recalled one story that Michael had told her about his travels with the royal family. During one royal tour, Michael was invited to a drinks reception with Queen Elizabeth II. After working on the broadcast, he'd been working in extreme heat to get everything ready on time and had ended up wearing his hotel bedroom slippers. As he was introduced, the Queen smiled, glanced down at his slippers, then back up again, clearly amused. She didn't say anything, but he always remembered that moment. He later heard that she and Prince Philip enjoyed it when things didn't go entirely to plan, when something human slipped through. The SIA says stories like Michael's highlight the importance of protecting access to specialist spinal cord injury services across England.
More than 50 people take part in ancient tradition. More than 50 people took part in the ancient tradition of beating the bounds. The event, held in St Albans, was led by the Mayor of St Albans City and District, Councillor Theresa Heritage, who walked the historic boundaries of the city in a ceremony dating back to 1327. Councillor Heritage said, "We had a lovely afternoon amid bracing walking weather, taking in the city's many fabulous attractions." The 4.5-mile walk began at the Pudding Stone in St Michael's Village, where willow wands were used to beat the ground. The tradition was designed to pass down knowledge of the city's boundaries and assert citizens' rights. Councillor Heritage was joined by Deputy Mayor Sue Griffiths, Town Crier Stephen Potter, and the Reverend Tim Vickers.
The next story comes from the Hearts Advertiser and has the headline, Vintage Police Car Spotted in Filming Near St Albans School. Yesterday morning, residents caught a glimpse of multiple classic vehicles around Sandringham Crescent and Wheatfield's Infants and Nursery School. Images show a white Rover police car used by the force during the late 1960s and 1970s. It was accompanied by two other vehicles, including a Volvo dating back to 1973 and an MK1 Granada from 1974. Later on in the day, film crews were spotted on site shooting scenes in the area, but no star actors could be seen. One eyewitness, who wished to remain anonymous, was told that filming was for the Netflix series Legends. The new drama, featuring Steve Coogan and Hayley Quires, has been well received. However, a second instalment is yet to be confirmed. In April, a vintage Porsche was on set in Woodland Drive as crews filmed the next series of the BBC's Dr. Foster. The shoot, which lasted 2 days, closed the residential road for external scenes and also saw filming inside a number of homes for internal shots.
Brilliant young filmmakers help bring Youth Talk campaign to life. Young people from Brilliant Film Academy have helped create a powerful new campaign film for St Albans mental health charity Youth Talk, highlighting the realities of growing up today and the importance of making sure young people have someone to talk to. Launched for Mental Health Awareness Week, the film is designed to encourage local people and businesses to support the charity's vital work and is being screened at the Odyssey Cinema in St Albans throughout the week. Created by Youth Talk and filmed in collaboration with local students from Brilliant Film Academy, the film combines honest reflections from young people and family members who have been supported by the charity. It delivers a clear message. Young people need to feel heard, understood, and supported. Students involved in the project use the power of storytelling through film to help spark more open conversations about mental health and remind young people that they are not alone in what they are feeling. David Jenkins, founder of Brilliant Film Academy, said, "Mental health affects so many young people now, and this was an incredibly meaningful project to be part of. At Brilliant Film Academy, we believe young people create their best work when they're trusted with real opportunities and real stories to tell. For our students to help create something that could genuinely encourage another young person to seek support makes us hugely proud." Odyssey manager Bethany Nicholson said, "We're incredibly proud to support Youth Talk and help bring this important campaign to the community during Mental Health Awareness Week. The film is powerful, honest, and deeply moving, and we hope screening it at the Odyssey encourages more conversations about young people's mental health and the importance of support." David Barker, CEO of Youth Talk, added, "It was great to work alongside students from Brilliant Film Academy and delightful to see young people making something for the benefit of other young people. The film was supported by a range of local businesses and community partners, including corporate partner KDW Financial Planning, which featured in the film, Bennett's Car Parts, which supported the filmmaking process, and Artaplasia Greek Bakery, George Street Canteen, and the Boot Pub, which all provided locations."
Fluffy peregrine chicks hatch atop St Albans Cathedral. A trio of fluffy peregrine falcon chicks have hatched on St Albans Cathedral over the weekend. The first sightings were of two white chicks around 2 a.m. on Saturday, May the 9th. Another hatched later that same day, and one egg remains on the nest. It is possible that a further chick may appear within the next couple of days. However, some eggs are infertile and do not hatch. This year's four eggs are a record number for the St Albans peregrine pair, with three eggs having been laid each year since 2023. A year prior, only two eggs were laid, one of which failed to hatch. The pair of peregrine falcons at St Albans Cathedral have captured the public's interest since that first chick in 2022. Curiosity in the birds and their growing family has been further heightened since a live webcam was installed on their nest tray in 2023. The web page received over 500,000 views last year. Leah Ellis, engagement manager at Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, said, "I'm thrilled to see the three peregrine chicks hatch in quick succession, and I expect that there will be many people like me who will be glued to the website in the coming days with the hope of seeing a further sibling join them on the nest tray. It is not unusual for the eggs to hatch hours or days apart, so as with watching all wildlife, patience is a virtue. For those watching the webcam, there will be times when the parents will be out of sight, but I'd urge people not to worry about this, as they will be close by to protect the chicks. Likewise, as the chicks develop and begin to move around more, they may disappear from the view of the webcam from time to time, but in all probability, they are just exploring the rest of the nest tray." The Very Reverend Joe Kelly Moore, Dean of St Albans, added, "We are absolutely delighted to welcome the first peregrine chicks of 2026 here at St Albans Cathedral. These remarkable birds have become much loved members of our cathedral community, and it is a joy to see their family continue to grow year after year. Witnessing new life emerge on our ancient walls is a wonderful reminder of God's creation thriving in unexpected places, and of the cathedral as a living, prayerful place at the heart of our city."
A letter to the newspaper from Katie Wilson in Hitchin, entitled "Exam Season." "Working in a school, I've come to see how deeply exam season affects young people. The pressure builds quietly over weeks, and when it finally reaches the surface, it often comes out as tears. From a psychological perspective, this isn't a sign of weakness. It's the body's natural response to prolonged stress. When a child has been holding everything together for too long, emotion becomes the release point. Their tears don't mean they're failing. They care, they're trying, and they've reached a moment where the weight simply needs to go somewhere. For many children, the hardest moment is when it becomes a reality that they are running out of time. That's when the pressure shifts from something distant to something immediate. Psychologists call this a perceived threat to control. The feeling that the outcome is slipping away, even when they've worked hard. It's not laziness or panic. It's the mind trying to make sense of a situation that suddenly feels too big. A child wipes the tears, takes a breath, gathers themselves, and tries again. Psychologists call this adaptive coping. The ability to continue even when emotions feel overwhelming. It's not about being calm all the time. It's about finding the strength to keep going. I want every child to know that their worth is not measured by a grade and their future is not decided by one exam. Strength isn't shown by never wobbling. It's shown by carrying on even when things feel difficult. Exams will come and go, but the qualities that truly shape a life, kindness, determination, creativity, compassion, are already growing in them long before they sit down at a desk with a paper in front of them. There's a quote I found on the internet. "Courage doesn't always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day saying, 'I will try again tomorrow.'" It captures exactly what I see in children of today, children of yesterday, and children throughout time. Not loud bravery, but steady, persistent courage. If you're a student facing an exam, feeling overwhelmed, you are doing better than you think, learning more than you realise, and you are stronger than you know. And if you're a parent, carer, or teacher watching a child struggle, sometimes the most powerful thing we can say is simply, I see how hard you're trying and I'm proud of you. Because in the end, exams test knowledge, but life rewards courage.
Welcome back to part two. As mentioned in the introduction, I'm going to give a brief history of women's struggle for voting rights and emancipation. The idea that women should have the same rights as men didn't pop up overnight. Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Women, 1792, was one of the first major arguments for women's education and moral equality, and those ideas fed into later campaigns. For most of the 19th century, married women had very little legal control over money and property. The Married Women's Property Acts, notably 1870 and 1882, began to change that, letting married women own and control property in their own names, a practical step towards independence. By the late 1800s, the campaign for the vote split into two main approaches. The suffragists, such as Millicent Garrett Fawcett and the NUWSS, who used petitions, speeches, lobbying and legal arguments, and the suffragettes, led by Emmeline Pankhurst and the WSPU, who used more militant tactics, including window smashing, disruption of public events and hunger strikes when imprisoned. The suffragettes' militant tactics drew attention, but also a harsh government response, including arrests, force feeding of hunger-striking prisoners, and the 1913 Cat and Mouse Law, which let authorities release weakened hunger strikers and then re-arrest them later. Emily Davison's death in the 1913 Epsom Derby, when she stepped in front of the King's horse and was fatally injured, became a powerful and controversial symbol of the struggle.
I'm leaving immediately, Chattanooga, here I come. Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga choo-choo? Right on track 29. Boy, you can give me a shine. I can't afford to board a Chattanooga choo-choo. I've got my fare, and just a trifle to spare. You leave the Pennsylvania station about a quarter to four. Read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore. Dinner in the diner, nothing could be finer than to have your ham and eggs in Carolina. When you hear the whistle blow and egg to the bar, then you know the Tennessee is not very far. Shovel all the coal in, gotta keep it rolling. Woo-woo, Chattanooga, there. gonna be a certain party at the station in satin and lace. I used to call funny face. She's gonna cry until I tell her that I'll never run.
When the First World War broke out in 1914, many women took on essential work in munitions, nursing, transport, clerical jobs and farms. Their contribution changed how many people viewed women's capabilities and responsibilities. After the war, the political context shifted. The Representation of the People's Act 1918 gave the vote to women over 30 who met certain property qualifications and also hugely expanded the male electorate. It was a major step, though not full equality. The same year, Parliament passed the Parliament Qualification of Women Act 1918, allowing women to stand for the House of Commons. Constance Markovitz was elected in 1918 as an Irish Sinn Féin MP, but didn't take her seat. Nancy Astor became the first woman to take her seat in 1919. The Representation of the People Equal Franchise Act 1928 lowered the voting age for women to 21, giving women electoral equality with men. The Sex Disqualification Removal Act of 1919 opened many professions and public offices to women, including law, the civil service and university posts. Later laws tackled workplace discrimination and pay. The Equal Pay Act of 1970 and the Sex Discrimination Act of 1975 were important steps in law, though practical gaps remained. However, laws changed faster than attitudes. Women's representation in Parliament and senior jobs rose slowly and unevenly, and problems such as gender pay gap, childcare access and intersecting inequalities continue to be issues. The suffrage movement left a big legacy. It showed how social campaigning, legal challenges and public pressure can reshape a democracy. Some may argue that women still have a long way to go before being fully recognised as equals to men. And in some cases, women might feel that tide is turning back. In summary, I think we have made enormous strides in the bid for equality, but as ever, there's always room for improvement.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend, 'cause I've heard it all before. And I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Oh, yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong.
Now we have the audiobook review, and this month's it's Heartburn by Nora Ephron. The excerpts you will hear in this item are read by our very own Mandy Jones, as we were not able to use the original audio. Nora Ephron, 1941 to 2012, was an American writer and filmmaker, known for her sharp, funny voice and keen observations about relationships, food and domestic life. She began her career in journalism and essay writing in the 1960s and 70s, publishing acclaimed collections such as Crazy Salad, 1975, and Scribble Scribble, 1978. Her semi-autobiographical novel Heartburn, 1983, established her as a novelist. The same year she earned wide recognition as a screenwriter with the film Silkwood, 1983. Ephron became a defining figure in modern romantic comedy as a writer and later a director of landmark films including When Harry Met Sally, 1989, This Is My Life, 1992, Sleepless in Seattle, 1993, Michael, 96, You've Got Mail, 98, and Julie and Julia, 2009. She also published popular essay collections later in her career, like I Feel Bad About My Neck, 2006. Across genres, Ephron's blend of wit, candidness and domestic detail made her a hugely influential cultural voice and helped shape contemporary screenwriting and comic memoir. So, we're actually here in the afternoon. We normally meet on a Monday morning, but we're here on a Thursday afternoon in the studio, and Demi and I are reviewing Nora Ephron's Heartburn, which I think we both enjoyed. I've certainly
very
enjoyed
much,
it.
Yeah, it is. A lovely feminist novel. When I say lovely, I don't mean that it was necessarily an easy thing to listen to in some places, but it was very well written and I felt just empowered.
It's set in the 70s, so it's not completely contemporary. Obviously, there's certain things that happened in the 70s, second wave feminism, that were around that time, but I don't think women necessarily quite had the status that they have these days, and I think it was certainly an era where things were changing, but hadn't changed completely. I'm not saying we've got equality now by any means, but it's written from the author's perspective, and it's actually autobiographical because she was actually married to Carl Bernstein, who was one of the Watergate journalists.
So the version I listened to, the Caliber version, did have an introduction where the author gave context. You know, she said, I am not a food writer. I made that bit up, but this bit is real and this bit is real. And my husband didn't like me writing that book. And that's hardly fair because I didn't really like him having an affair.
That's right.
Which caused me to write the book. So, yeah.
He tried to sue her. Well, he did sue her, but unsuccessfully. She was married to him. She was pregnant at the time when he had the affair. And so, yeah, I can imagine why she felt the way she did. In fact, she wanted to write about it. So, yeah, it's autobiographical, but obviously names have been changed. And it really does examine a marriage that's falling apart, doesn't it? It's quite sad in a lot of ways.
It is sad. And it's not even a long-term marriage. They haven't been married that long.
No. And she's 7 months pregnant when she starts to retell the tale of her husband's infidelity and what's been going on.
And we're not giving you spoilers. This is, you know, right from the beginning. This is about her discovering that he's been having an affair with someone who is too tall. She's very clear about this. Too tall, with a nose as long as a thumb. And I thought to myself, I started measuring my own nose. I'm like, but my nose is as long as a thumb. But I think they don't mean from top to bottom. They mean from face outwards, which is quite a long nose.
Yeah, that's a very funny scene. And I think we should include an excerpt from the audiobook. Let's have a listen.
I told them a little bit about Thelma. I said she had a nose as long as a thumb and walked like a penguin. That made me feel better. I said Mark was a schmuck. That made me feel even better. I told the part about all three of them going to see the Central American burrito and her dwarf dog. And I said how unfair it was that I couldn't even date. She must be feeling better, said Ellis. She's making jokes. She makes jokes even when she's feeling terrible, said Vera. Don't let her fool you. Why do you have to make everything into a joke? Asked Diana. Oh, I don't have to make everything into a joke, I said. I have to make everything into a story. Remember? How do you feel? Asked Eve. Hurt. Angry. Stupid. Miserable. I thought for a minute. And guilty.
Yes, and it's how she navigates that, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And she's also a food writer and seems to have a TV show as well. So there are recipes interspersed in it, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah.
She would say how to make salad dressing or how to make an apple pie or something like that.
And the funny one was the rice pudding recipe. She said, I'm not going to give a rice pudding recipe because not many people like it. And if you like it, you will have a version you like. And if you marry someone who likes it, you will have to learn to like it. But, yeah, no one is going to go out of their way to make a rice pudding, are they?
That's true. But there is a good structure to the story by using these recipes that sort of get you from one chapter to the next. She's suffering. I mean, obviously suffering quite badly. She's discovered this affair that her husband's having. But she does it with great wit and humour. And I think that's what drives you through the book, isn't it? It's very funny.
Yeah, I have one favourite bit, and that is her way of getting her own back on the lady with the very long nose who has stolen her husband away by spreading a rumour that she has a lady's infection, which I thought was hilarious.
And sat telling it to the biggest gossip that she knows.
Yeah.
And we should have a clip of that particular piece.
Definitely.
Yeah, definitely have a clip there.
She wanted some legal advice, I said. She got the infection in a Vietnamese restaurant in Virginia, and she wants to sue them. She got it from something she ate or from the toilet seat, said Betty. The toilet seat, I guess, I said. Although I'm not sure, maybe the spring rolls. Oh, God, said Betty. Poor Thelma. Poor Thelma, I said. I feel so sorry for her, said Betty. Don't feel too sorry for her, I said. It's curable, eventually. Maybe I should have her and Jonathan to dinner, said Betty. Don't, I said. Why not, said Betty. It's not catching, is it? No, I said, it's just that she's so depressed. She's no fun to be around. I think we should have a dance, said Betty. What, I said, the three of us? You, me and Thelma? I hate dances, I said. It'll be fun, Rachel, said Betty. I can't dance, I said. Come on, said Betty. Where do you think we should do it? The White House, I said. That's a great idea, said Betty. They're always talking about opening it up to the public. I'll call the social secretary. Betty, and let's have lunch, the three of us. Next week, Tuesday. Tuesday, I have to be in New York to do a cooking demonstration. Rachel, you really are impossible, said Betty. Thelma and I will have lunch on Tuesday. We will plan the dance. It will make Thelma feel better about her infection, and you'll have something to take your mind off the robbery. My mind isn't on the robbery, I said. Good, said Betty. Start making your guest list. Oh, Thelma's going to want to invite the Kissingers, I said. Is that the kind of dance you want to have?
Yeah, that's a great scene and funny, and she knows because of her community that that gossip will get around. She is part of a Jewish community and she seems to have a lot of friends in that community and they all seem to know each other. And I think the kind of Jewish sense of humour comes across in it as well, quite self-deprecating. But yeah, it's fun. No, fun's not the right word.
But it is kind of fun, yeah. Isn't it? It's a serious message. And I love this when a writer on whatever format, I mean, for me, it's plays generally, but the same in a novel. If they can take something that's quite serious and find the light side without disrespecting the serious message, because life is funny. Life is very hard as well.
Yeah.
But you can always find the funny moments.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's her way of dealing with her pain, isn't it?
Yeah. By
cracking jokes, basically, and telling anecdotes and being funny. And even some of her friends say to her, oh, you're kind of covering up what you're really feeling by being funny. And she sort of says, yes, but I'd rather be funny and then be sitting here crying, which is probably a good point.
Yeah. So you spoke about the way Nora Ephron uses recipes to punctuate the story. And that seemed quite a dramatic function to me. So with my background in theatre, this is how I would use incidental music between scenes, you know, to set the tone. And it wasn't till a bit later that someone said, oh, she's the person who wrote When Harry Met Sally. And you've just told me Sleepless in Seattle.
Yep.
So you can see the beginnings of dramatic writing, can't you? Because it is quite a visual book.
Yes. Very much so. She was a journalist before then. And she's written, I mean, I think most people know Sleepless in Seattle and When Harry Met Sally. They're the very, very famous rom-coms. So she says quite openly that everything in her life is open to copy, as she would say, as to be written about. So I think she's used a lot of her own experience in these films and in the writing. I think it's quite brave to write very personal things. Do you? I mean,
yeah, definitely. People have said to me, oh, why don't you write a play about sight loss? And yeah, I could do that, but I don't like to just be defined by my disability, you see. But then again, I'd much rather someone wrote about sight loss from first-hand knowledge than someone write a blind character in.
Yes,
which
that's
can
true.
Really offend me.
Yeah.
So would I do that? Probably not. I have written a semi-autobiographical monologue, but it's not something I do as a rule, so I think she's really brave.
Yeah, I do too. I prefer my private life to say private, but she seems to put everything out there, and I think, obviously, with this particular novel, I think it's brutally honest, yeah, as to how she felt during the time, whether it's a biased view and it's her view, and obviously her husband would have a different take on it. But I think it is very brave to put absolute details of your personal life out there. But she seems to be brazen about it, and she says there's nothing that's off limits. So either you kind of wear your heart on your sleeve and you tell everybody how you're feeling, or you prefer not to.
Yeah, which is great, because there'll be other women going through what she's going through.
Yeah.
And, they will find a link with it and hopefully be uplifted. It is an uplifting story.
Yes, yeah, so we're talking about a marital affair, but as you say, it's not depressing by any...
No, it's about her taking control of the situation, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, I think we've got a great example of that in the audio book. Let's listen to an excerpt.
My mother taught me many things when I was growing up, but the main thing I learned from her is that everything is copy. She said it again and again, and I have quoted her saying it again and again. As a result, I knew the moment my marriage ended that someday it might make a book. If I could just stop crying. One of the things I'm proudest of is that I managed to convert an event that seemed to me hideously tragic at the time to a comedy. And if that's not fiction, I don't know what is.
Shall we go through our three top reasons for listening to this audiobook? What do you think, Debbie?
It's short. What was it, about six hours?
6 hours?
Yeah.
We seem to be always...
You see, this is relevant, really, isn't it, for talking newspaper listeners? Because I can't, unfortunately now, because I can't read physically, I can't read a long book because it takes so much longer to listen to a book.
Yeah.
Yes, you can put it on double speed. So this is really a factor of consideration, isn't it? Because it will probably take the average person about 6 hours to read a longer book.
Yeah.
So this sort of puts us on a level pegging. This is a good way to spend 6 hours of your time. As we've said, it's a good feminist novel without it being...
It's not preachy, is it?
It is not preachy. It's a good story. It's a non-preachy, uplifting feminist novel, and it's very funny. Those are my three. What about you?
No, I agree with that. And I think any gentleman listening would enjoy it too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's not just for women in that sense. It's a funny novel. And I think anyone can empathise with the characters. I mean, we've probably all been through relationships where something awful's happened. So in that case, it's a good listen for that. I mean, she's a very believable character. She's a very warm character. So you're instantly warm to her. And you want to know what's going to happen to her and how she's going to resolve all these issues she's got. I think if you have to listen to a novel about a marriage breakup, this is probably the best one to do it, because it is light-hearted with a very serious undertone. And I think she's achieved that very well. I mean, that's quite a delicate balance, I think, as a writer.
Is it a novel?
Oh, good question. Is it a novel? Is it a piece of...
It's therapeutic for her, isn't it? I'm not sure... I suppose it is sort of a novel, but it's not necessarily a fictional novel, if that makes sense. It's based
on a lot of facts, yes.
It's a story with a beginning, a middle and an end, which is factually accurate.
Mm.
In the introduction on the Caliber version, she does talk about that point, is it a novel or not? And lots of people have said it's not. I think it is a novel, but not in a conventional way.
Yeah. I could see her doing stand-up and having that sort of routine, doing it to an audience, and that would be quite funny.
Yeah.
A really easy listen. I didn't struggle to listen to it at all. I didn't have to go back and re-listen to any of it.
No, it was
very straightforward. Mm. 6 hours. If you've got a couple of afternoons free, there you go. Mm. That's what you should be doing, listening to this book. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Debbie. We'll see you next time.
Thank you for suggesting it. Great book.
Up next, birthdays and events from this week in history. And now we have some famous people's birthdays from the 17th to the 23rd of May. On the 17th of May, 1961, Enya was born. She is an Irish singer and composer, with an estimated equivalent of more than 80 million albums sold worldwide.
Ennio is one of the world's best-selling music artists, and Ennio's music has been widely recognised for its use of multi-layers of her own voice and instrumentation, lengthened reverb and interwoven elements of Celtic music. On the 18th of May 1909, Fred Perry was born. He was a British tennis and table tennis player and former world number one from England, who won 10 majors, including 8 Grand Slam tournaments and 2 Pro Slam single titles, as well as 6 major doubles titles. On the 19th of May 1948, Grace Jones was born. She is a Jamaican singer, songwriter, model and actress. She became known for her distinctive androgynous appearance and bold features. On the 20th of May in 1964, Charles Spencer, 9th Earl of Spencer, was born. He is a British peer, author, journalist and broadcaster. Spencer is the younger brother of Dinah, Princess of Wales, and is the maternal uncle of William, Prince of Wales, and Prince Harry, Duke of Sussex. On the 21st of May 1948, Leo Sayer was born. He is an English-Australian singer and songwriter. Sayer became a top singles and album act on both sides of the Atlantic in the 1970s. On the 22nd of May in 1907, Sir Laurence Olivier was born. He was an English actor and director. He worked in films throughout his career, playing more than 50 cinematic roles. Later in his career, he had considerable success in television roles. On the 23rd of May 1938, Johnny Ball was born. He is an English television personality and a popularizer of mathematics. He continued to appear regularly on British television, making guest appearances, presenting programs, or featuring in television and radio advertisements over several decades. He has also published a number of non-fiction books. And that's it for famous people's birthdays this week in history.
Hello, this is Claire with the On This Week in History segment, where we take a look back at notable events in history connected with the week from the 17th of May to the 23rd of May. These events range from law and civil rights to crusading history, Tudor politics, aviation, modern terrorism, and European welfare. We begin on the 17th of May 1954 with one of the most important legal decisions in modern American history, Brown versus the Board of Education. On this day, the United States Supreme Court ruled unanimously that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. Before this decision, many American states, especially in the South, operated under the doctrine of separate but equal. The court, led by Chief Justice Earl Warren, rejected that doctrine. It held that segregated schools were inherently unequal because separation itself marked black children as inferior. This decision did not end segregation overnight, and in many places was fiercely resisted, but it gave the civil rights movement a constitutional weapon, and it remains one of the landmark rulings in the history of equality before the law. On the 18th of May 1291, we turn to the Eastern Mediterranean and the fall of Acre. Acre was the last major crusader stronghold in the Holy Land. For nearly 2 centuries, European crusaders had tried to hold territory in the Levant, with varying degrees of success and failure. By the late 13th century, their position had become increasingly fragile. Acre was crowded, divided, and politically unstable. In 1291, the Mamluks, the powerful Muslim rulers of Egypt and Syria, besieged the city. After brutal fighting, Acre fell on the 18th of May. There would still be crusading schemes and military expeditions afterwards, but the dream of holding Jerusalem and the surrounding lands as permanent Christian kingdoms had, in practical terms, collapsed. On the 19th of May 1536, we come to one of the most famous executions in English history, the death of Anne Boleyn. Anne was the second wife of King Henry VIII and the mother of the future Queen Elizabeth I. Henry's desire to marry Anne had helped drive England's break with Rome because the Pope wouldn't annul Henry's first marriage to Catherine of Aragon. Anne, therefore, stood at the centre of one of the great religious and political upheavals of English history. Accused of adultery, incest, and treason, Anne was condemned to death. The charges have long been disputed, and historians today regard them as politically convenient rather than credible. On the 19th of May 1536, she was executed within the Tower of London by a swordsman brought from France. Anne's daughter Elizabeth, however, would later become one of England's greatest monarchs, giving Anne's story a bitter historical irony. On the 20th of May 1927, we move from the Tower of London to the age of aviation with Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight. On this day, Lindbergh took off from Roosevelt Field in New York in the single-engine aircraft Spirit of St. Louis. His aim was to fly alone, non-stop, across the Atlantic Ocean to Paris. This was an extraordinarily dangerous undertaking. Aviation was still young, aircraft were fragile by modern standards, and the Atlantic was an unforgiving expanse. Lindbergh flew for more than 33 hours, battling exhaustion as much as the elements. He landed at Le Bourgneuf Field near Paris on the 21st of May. Strictly speaking, then, the 20th of May marks the beginning of the flight, not its completion. But that takeoff was the start of one of the most celebrated journeys in aviation history. Lindbergh became the first person to fly solo and non-stop across the Atlantic, and for a time became one of the most famous men in the world. On the 21st of May 1991, we turn to India and the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi. Rajiv Gandhi had served as Prime Minister of India from 1984 to 1989. He entered politics after the death of his younger brother and became Prime Minister following the assassination of his mother, Indira Gandhi. On the 21st of May 1991, while campaigning in Tamil Nadu, Rajiv Gandhi was killed by a suicide bomber linked to the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, also known as the Tamil Tigers. The attack shocked India and the wider world. His assassination also had lasting consequences for Indian politics and for the conflict in Sri Lanka, where the Tamil Tigers were fighting for a separate Tamil state. On the 22nd of May 2017, we come to a much more recent tragedy, the Manchester Arena bombing. At the end of an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, a suicide bomber detonated an explosive device in the foyer area of the arena. 22 people were killed, many of them children, and many more were injured. The attack was deliberately aimed at a crowd leaving a music event, making it especially cruel in its choice of target. The bombing caused grief across Britain and beyond. It also led to serious questions about security, intelligence, and the monitoring of extremist threats. But the immediate public response was also marked by courage and decency, as is the British spirit. Taxi drivers offered free lifts, local people opened their homes, emergency workers ran towards danger, and Manchester refused to let the atrocity define the city. But it remains one of the darkest days in recent British history. Finally, on the 23rd of May 1706, we end with the Battle of Ramillies, fought during the War of the Spanish Succession. The battle took place in what is now Belgium. On one side were French forces under the Duke of Villeroy. On the other were Allied forces commanded by John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough. Marlborough was already one of the great commanders of his age, and at Ramillies he confirmed that reputation. The Allied victory was overwhelming. Marlborough's manoeuvres broke the French line and forced a major retreat. As a result, much of the Spanish Netherlands fell into Allied hands, and French prestige suffered badly. The battle is less well known today than Waterloo or Agincourt, but in its own age, it was a major event in the struggle to contain French power under Louis XIV. So from the schoolrooms of America to the walls of Acre, from Tudor England to the skies over the Atlantic, and from modern Manchester back to the battlefields of early Europe, this week offers a striking cross-section of history.
Next up, Blind Baker Penny with her recipe for stuffed peppers.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, I'm Penny Melville Brown, the blind baker. The recipe this time is simple stuffed peppers. And I know that can be very ordinary, but I want us to think about it as a way of using up vegetables, perhaps at the end of a week. It makes a really simple, light meal, half a pepper, piece of really nice bread. Dead easy to make. And actually, you could make this all in the microwave, or you could make it in the oven, whichever you like. What I do with mine is I make enough for six meals. It will keep well in the fridge, and then I just whip it out and pop it in the microwave, and I've got a hot meal when I want it. So what we're going to need to start with is an oven-proof dish. Ideally with a flat bottom, because you're going to have all these bubbly peppers sitting in it. I like a Pyrex dish, and I've got some nice ones which have got a plastic lid, so it stores in the fridge. And a mixing bowl is a good idea too. So here we go with the ingredients. And with the ingredients, you know that I like to do things in handfuls, because getting out the scales and weighing everything is a bit tedious. So if a handful will do, that's good enough for me. So I'm going to start off with a handful of mushrooms. And what I'm going to do with those is just trim them. Don't wash them, because water and mushrooms don't really mix very well. Give them a good slicing. You want them quite small. And then I'm going to throw them into a bowl, into the microwave, and I'm just going to heat them for a minute or two. And this is because mushrooms have got lots of bulk, because they've got water in them. And I'd rather they cooked and reduced and got smaller now before I mix them in with the rest of the ingredients. So in my mixing bowl, I'm going to put in one or two tomatoes. And I'm going to dice those, nothing more complicated than that. A courgette, top and tail it, dice that. If I'm feeling a bit exotic, perhaps five or six olives, black or green, don't mind which. Again, chop those a little bit small. I like to put in some ham, or actually chorizo sausage is very good. And for this, I'm thinking here we're making enough to stuff one pepper, one red or green pepper. Chorizo sausage, perhaps an inch or two. Ham, perhaps a couple of slices. Just chop them up small, and those go into the mixing bowl too. A tablespoonful of oil and a bit of pepper. I wouldn't put salt in if I'm putting in the ham or the chorizo, but you would need it if you were left those out and just had a vegan version. And for more flavouring, I'm going to use three spring onions. And I very much like spring onions, because if you're not doing vast amounts of cooking, three spring onions is all you need for this dish, just peeled, trimmed and chopped up. Whereas to get out a whole onion, where you might only need half of it, what do you do with the other half? Just sits in the fridge until it goes off. If I've got some herbs from the garden, probably some soft herbs. So that could be some thyme leaves, some parsley, some coriander, anything else you've got in the garden that you could pop in. So adding all of that in to my mixing bowl. And finally, I'm getting to my pepper. So you cut the pepper in half lengthways, and then scoop out all the seeds and throw all of those away. So now I've got my pepper, put it in my oven-proof dish, stuff it with my mix that I've just stirred up, and I confess, I put it in by hand, because it's so much easier for me to manage when I can't see. And if I've got some mix left over, I simply put that in the dish to hold the two peppers up, and that will actually probably do another meal or even two. The next complicated thing is you put the oven on and you put it in the oven, about 180 degrees Celsius, gas mark 4, for about 30, 35 minutes. And this will really depend on the size of your peppers, because you want a eating knife, a dining knife, to be able to go through the pepper so that you can actually cut it up to eat. Otherwise, it's going to be too difficult. And that really is all there is to it. You could, if you wanted to, cook all of this in the microwave. So never mind putting these pepper halves into the oven. Just pop them on a plate in the microwave. It will be different, because part of the point about the oven is it will just char some bits, cook some bits. It will be a different texture and a different finish, but perfectly delicious out of the microwave. And the other thing that you might want to do, and I certainly do, is chop up the peppers, and don't even bother to stuff them. Just chop them up, add them to the mix, pop them into a ramekin that can go into the oven to cook, just as we've said, or go into the microwave. Because for me, when I don't tend to use a knife and fork because I can't see, and it's too difficult to cut things up. I have to use my fingers and a knife to chop things up. So I would rather just use a fork like the Americans do and eat like that. So there you are, a very simple stuffed pepper. Simple supper, simple lunch, easy to do, keeps well in the fridge, reheat in the microwave. I hope you enjoy this recipe. I hope you give it a try. If you've got ideas or suggestions for future recipes, please get in touch with me. You can always make contact through my website, www.pennymelvillebrown.com. And happy baking to all of you too. Bye-bye.
TNF Soundings.
And now the audio described TV and radio listings.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Diane welcoming you to your audio described TV programme starting Saturday 16th and ending Friday 22nd of May, which has been written by Christine. Starting with Saturday, Channel 4's American sitcoms run from 6am to 12:35, while over on BBC Two, Bill Bailey introduces us to some eccentric animals who turn oddness into opportunity in Nature's Misfits at 8:30am. James Martin begins the Texan leg of his American adventure by visiting San Antonio on ITV at 12:45, and then you have an afternoon film choice on Channel 4 at 1:05pm. Teen comedy, 10 Things I Hate About You. Andy Oliver heads to Bridlington in her Fabulous Feasts cookery series at 2 o'clock on BBC Two. And there's more for foodies at 5:35 on Channel 4 with Jamie's Ultimate Barbecue. Your evening choices begin at 7pm on BBC Two with the start of a new six-part series, Treasures of the National Trust, while Channel 4 takes you to the Yorkshire Moors for Steam Train Diaries. At 8, you can choose from BBC One's Eurovision Song Contest Grand Final, live from Vienna, two episodes of ITV's It'll Be All Right on the Night, Channel 4's World's Most Secret Hotels, and on BBC Two, Churchill must decide whether to negotiate with Hitler or fight for the greater good in the film Darkest Hour. There are three more evening film options for you. On ITV, it's action crime drama The Batman at 9:15, and on Channel 4, thriller sequel The Equalizer 2 at 9 o'clock. And historical drama The Last Duel at 11:20pm. On to Sunday. American sitcoms run through Sunday morning on Channel 4, while on BBC One you have the Minions film at 10:30am, followed at 11:55 by three short films based on Julia Donaldson's Zog books.
The afternoon begins with Alan Titchmarsh helping to create a sensory wonderland for a five-year-old with severe epilepsy in Love Your Garden on ITV at 12:25, whilst BBC One offers Bargain Hunt at 1:50, followed by two episodes of The Americas from 2:35. There are two musical comedy film choices on Sunday afternoon. The classic Gentlemen Prefer Blondes on BBC Two at 2:30 and the sequel Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again on ITV at 3:05. Kirsty and Phil continue to Love It or List It on Channel 4 at 4:35, followed by George Clark's Amazing Spaces at 5:35. Into the evening, it's The Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7 and An Expedition with Steve Backshall on BBC 2 at 7:15, whilst BBC 1 has the first of a six-part series, Death Valley, at 8:15. You can travel to Alaska with Channel 4's Cruising to the Ends of the Earth at 8 p.m. and from the fjords of Norway to Iceland with Simon Reeve in his Scandinavia series on BBC Two at 9. Also at 9, ITV series Believe Me continues. There's the penultimate episode of BBC One's The Cage and it's the grand final for the singers in Your Song on Channel 4, followed by Gogglebox at 10:05. Australian mystery drama The Family Next Door kicks off with two episodes on ITV at 10:20 and 11:20, and then you have two late-night film choices. On BBC Two at 10:50, two brothers navigate grief and tenderness amid Toronto's ganglands in Brother, and on Channel 4 at 11:05, three superhumans team up to escape a psychiatric ward in Glass. Now the programmes which are on at the same time, same channel, each weekday. Channel 4 has episodes of Everybody Loves Raymond from 7:50 a.m. and Frasier from 9:10 a.m. Find It, Fix It, Flog It is at 12:10 p.m. Escape to Florida is at 4 and Chateau DIY is at 5. BBC One's Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:30 a.m. and The Repair Shop on the Road is at 3:45 p.m. ITV's Dickinson's Real Deal is at 2 p.m. BBC Two explores the wonders of life with Professor Brian Cox at 3:30 p.m. and follows Michael Portillo's Great Continental Railway Journeys at 6:30 p.m. Then for the soaps, EastEnders at 7:30 on BBC One every weekday except Friday, Emmerdale at 8 o'clock and Coronation Street at 8:30 on ITV every weekday. Now on to Monday. Into the evening and archaeologists are digging for Britain again on BBC Two at 7 and it's Back to the Doghouse on Channel 4 at 8. Your 9 o'clock choices are the final episode of The Cage on BBC One, Lucy Worsley investigating the explosive 18th century breakup between Britain and America on BBC Two, episode 4 of ITV series Believe Me and Channel 4's Virgin Island. At 10, there's another Virgin Island on Channel 4, while over on BBC Two, Mortimer and Whitehouse have gone fishing. And at 10:45, ITV has two episodes of its Australian mystery drama, The Family Next Door. The final episode of BBC Two's The Nevada Casino Heist is at 11. It's First Dates on Channel 4 at 11:05. And you have a film option on BBC One at 11:10, Crazy Rich Asians, where a New Yorker discovers her boyfriend is from one of Singapore's wealthiest families. On Tuesday, Bargain Hunt is on BBC One at 12:15. Then it's into the evening with Alan Carr's Interior Design Masters on BBC One and Jamie's Ultimate Barbecue on Channel 4. These are both at 8 p.m. At 9 o'clock, Knockout Week begins with the hopefuls working in a restaurant for the first time in MasterChef on BBC One. True Crime Presents is on ITV. And there's the start of a new six-part series on Channel 4. devoted nun Anna's attraction to priest Father David threatens to disrupt her peaceful life in Falling. Naturalist Steve Backshall takes you on a new expedition series at 9:45 on BBC Two, and you have 24 hours in A&E on Channel 4 at 10:05, followed by Celebrity Gogglebox at 11:10. BBC One's Half Man series is at 10:40, and there are two episodes of The Family Next Door on ITV from 10:45. Next, your programmes for Wednesday. The Future with Hannah Fry investigates whether artificial intelligence can read our emotions better than a human on BBC Two, while Alison Hammond's For the Love of Dogs is on ITV, both of these at 7:30pm. MasterChef continues on BBC One at 8, and at 9 you have a choice of Amandaland on BBC One, Surgeons at the Edge of Life on BBC Two, A Taste for Murder on ITV, and the second episode of Falling on Channel 4. BBC One's Only Child series is at 9:30, and from 10 o'clock on Channel 4, a two-part documentary, Marilyn and the Mob, tells the story of how Marilyn Monroe was caught at the centre of a volatile power struggle in 1950s Hollywood. Now on to Thursday. Rue Irvine presents a special edition of Bargain Hunt on BBC One at 12:15, revisiting Asian items which have appeared on the show. And on BBC Two at 2:45, a Sydney socialite and an ex-London lawyer inherit a vineyard in New Zealand in the start of a six-part drama series, Under the Vines. It's the final of Race Across the World at 8 on BBC One, with the teams facing one last test of endurance to reach the finish line in Mongolia. Then at 9, you can hear their stories 6 months on in Race Across the World, The Reunion. Whitby, Scarborough and Filey feature in Yorkshire by the Sea on Channel 4 at 8. And at 9, you have Channel 4's Taskmaster, ITV's Long Lost Family, and on BBC Two, The Elon Musk Show, which explores the tech billionaire's takeover of Twitter and his evolution into a controversial political figure. Action fantasy The Dark Knight Rises is your evening film option at 10:45, and you have Surgeons at the Edge of Life on BBC Two at 11 and Gogglebox on Channel 4 at 11:05. Finally, on to Friday. Pet-related pieces which have featured in the show are revisited in a special edition of Bargain Hunt at 12:15 on BBC One, and BBC Two's Under the Vines series continues at 2:45. You can visit Greatest Gardens at 7 on BBC Two, and at 7:30 you have Bradley and Barney Walsh in Breaking Dad, or BBC One's The Marvellous Miniature Workshop. At 8pm, the remaining 10 chefs are tasked with making the perfect pizza in MasterChef on BBC One. And on Channel 4, you can visit the world's biggest curry restaurant, followed by Gogglebox at 9 and First Dates at 10. Over on BBC Two at 9, Altrincham Hall in Shropshire and Ickworth House in Suffolk are featured in Hidden Treasures of the National Trust. And Mrs. Brown's Boys are on BBC One at 9:30. You have two film choices this evening, The Batman on ITV at 10:45, and a film anthology of classic Monty Python sketches in And Now for Something Completely Different on BBC Two at 11pm, with BBC One airing two episodes of St. Denis Medical from 11:40pm. That's it for this week. We do hope you find plenty of programmes to enjoy, and we look forward to updating you again next week.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, I'm David, and I'm bringing you some radio highlights for this coming week that I hope you will enjoy listening to in the days ahead. Start with Saturday the 16th of May. Radio Times Choice 60 Years of Hurt first in a new series exploring the meaning of England and Englishness through the history of the English men's football team. David Baddiel takes us back to the memorable events of 1966, and that's on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, repeated on Monday at 3:30 p.m. Today's vintage comedy is an episode of Beyond Our Ken on Radio 4 Extra at 9:30 a.m, repeated at 2:30 and 8:30 p.m. Also on Radio 4 Extra is Equus, the psychodrama by Sir Peter Shaffer, where a psychiatrist tries to unravel the mystery as to why a 17-year-old stable boy would injure the horses in his care. That's on Radio 4 Extra at 5 p.m. Opera on 3 is Britain's The Turn of the Screw on Radio 3 at 6 p.m. And today is the final of the Eurovision Song Contest, and you can hear all the action live from the Vienna City Hall from 8 p.m. to midnight on Radio 2. And then Sunday, the 17th of May. Sunday worship this morning comes from Cardiff on Radio 4 at 8:10 a.m. Lauren Laverne's guest on this week's Desert Island Discs is Gary O'Donoghue, the BBC's chief North American correspondent. Gary lost his sight in childhood and speaks of the challenges of not being able to observe what is happening. Desert Island Discs is on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, repeated on Friday at 9 a.m. Private Passions on Radio 3 brings you an interview with the historian Michael Wood, and that's on Radio 3 at midday. Today's vintage comedy is a 1966 episode with Frankie Howard on Radio 4 Extra at 3:30 and 9:30 p.m. And at 5 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, you can listen to a 2020 edition of Desert Island Discs with the naturalist Steve Backshall. Desert Island Discs Revisited is on Radio 4 Extra at 5 p.m. Choral Evensong on the Eve of Ascension comes from Bristol Cathedral. That's on Radio 3 at 6 p.m. Just One Thing with Michael Mosley. Have a cup of tea, explaining the helpful and relaxing benefits of drinking tea. And that's on Radio 4 at 7:45 p.m. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. The Essay, Full Moon on Progress Street, is on Radio 3 each day at 9:45 a.m. Book of the Week on Radio 4 continues with episodes 6 to 10 of Weimar, the story of the residents of the German town of Weimar during the rise and reign of Hitler, on Radio 4 at 11:45 each morning. In Rinst, Kate Lamble continues her examination of the UK water industry. That's on Radio 4 each day at 1:45 p.m. Radio 3's Composer of the Week is the 16th century Italian composer Pier Luigi da Palestrina, each day at 4 p.m. on Radio 3. This week's Book at Bedtime continues reading Hunger and Thirst by Claire Fuller, Radio 4, 10:45 p.m. each evening. Monday, the 18th of May. Today's vintage comedy selection is a 1976 episode of Dad's Army on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. Classical Live with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra is at 1 p.m. on Radio 3. And The Conversation on the BBC World Service delves into the scam of romance fraud, speaking to two victims about their experiences. That's 1:30 p.m. on BBC World Service, repeated at 10:30 p.m. In Great Lives on Radio 4, Matthew Paris and Adrian Edmondson nominate the late British folk rock singer-songwriter Sandy Denny, Radio 4 at 3 p.m. Radio 3 in concert this evening brings you an evening with the LSO from the Barbican, with music from Britten, Bernstein and Tchaikovsky, 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Now, Tuesday, the 19th of May. Screenshot on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. explores how Mel Brooks, who'll be 100 in June, turned satire into an art form. That's Radio 4 at 11 a.m. And Vintage Comedy on Radio 4 Extra is a 1958 episode of The Goon Show, and that's at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. In the Studio presents an interview with Thomas Keneally, the 90-year-old author of Schindler's Ark, and that's 1:30 p.m. on BBC World Service, repeated at 10:30 p.m. Radio Times Choice, Trimerous, Three Heroines Unearthed, a drama by Kamal Khan celebrating the stories of three British female horticulturalists. And that's on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Another Radio Times Choice, a profile of Martha Graham, considered by many to be the mother of modern dance. Mother, 100 Years of Martha Graham Dance, is on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. And then on to Wednesday, the 20th of May. To Catch a King, examining how the people smuggling trade has evolved. And that's on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. Hancock's Half Hour is today's vintage comedy with an episode from 1955 on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. Choral Evensong with the BBC Singers comes from St Paul's Knightsbridge on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. And in the Friendly Virus, science journalist Marnie Chesterton reports on developments on bacteriophages, viruses so small that they can attack and kill other viruses that have become resistant to antibiotics. And that's on Radio 4 at 3:30 p.m. And the Ulster Orchestra features in Radio 3 in concert, with music from Stravinsky and Schubert on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. The comic spy novel So Very Secret by Barbara Pym is dramatised on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m, repeated at 9 p.m. And then on to Thursday, the 21st of May. The Berkis Way, a series of comedy sketches, is today's vintage comedy. That's on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, repeated at 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. In Scam Secrets, Shari Val looks at the latest techniques used by scammers. Radio 4 at 4 minutes past midday. And the musical Nanny is set in a stay-and-play toddlers group. That's at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Radio 3 in concert this evening is from the Barbican, with the BBC Symphony Orchestra continuing the celebration of America's 250th year. And that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And then Friday, the 22nd of May. Vintage Comedy today is an episode of Steptoe and Son from 1974. And you can listen to that on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, repeated at 12:30 and 6:30 p.m. The food programme heads to Belfast and to the Balmoral Show in Lisburn for the BBC Food and Farming Awards 2026 launch. And you can listen to that on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. Heart and Soul, how Irish humanitarian Addie Roach's Christian faith inspired decades of work with children affected by the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. That's on BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m, repeated at 10:30 p.m. Friday night is Music Night, with music from period dramas, including Bridgerton, Downton Abbey and Pride and Prejudice. And that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. And that concludes my selection for this week. I do hope you have found it both helpful and entertaining.
TNS Soundings.
And next we have a poem called Nameless Pain by Elizabeth Drew Bastard Stoddard. This was written in the 1850s and has the early beginnings of a feminist message. It's a five-verse poem. There's a lot of emotion in it, especially in the first verse. Often the speaker is trying to convince herself of something she doesn't quite believe or convey a message by not actually delivering it. Here's the poem. I should be happy with my lot, a wife and mother. Is it not enough for me to be content? What other blessing should be sent? A quiet house, homely ways, to make each day like other days. I only see time's shadow now, darken the hair on my baby's brow. No world's work ever comes to me, no beggar brings his misery. I have no power, no healing art, with bruised soul or broken heart. I read the poets of the age, tis lotus eating in a cage. I study art, but art is dead, to one who clamours to be fed. With milk from nature's rugged breast, who longs for labour's lusty rest? Oh, foolish wish, I still should pine if any other lot were mine. And now here's a much-anticipated interview with Jill Burridge.
Jenny Murray was one of the best recognised voices in radio. She was born in 1950 in Barnsley in Yorkshire, and she went to school there and then to university in Hull. So it must have been a bit of a geographical shock when she went to Bristol to join the BBC through the traditional route, local radio first. She then went to BBC South, where she was newsreader and presenter, then into BBC Television Newsnight, then to Today, BBC radio programme Today, and from there to Woman's Hour, where she took over from Sue McGregor in 1987, and she actually was there for 33 years. My guest, Jill Burridge, actually worked with her. She knew her well, and she also had a career in radio, starting in local radio, and then working up, and she became the editor of Woman's Hour in 2002.
Yes, that's right. I'd been a producer on Woman's Hour, but also on a programme called Treasure Islands, which was about children's books. It was for adults, but it was about children's books, and it was presented by Michael Rosen. I was a freelance at that stage. So I was also doing items for Woman's Hour and came across Jenny in that context. And then when Treasure Islands finished, I did more for Woman's Hour. I've always worked for Woman's Hour. I was a producer on it back in the 70s, actually. After local radio, I went to Woman's Hour. So I was very well versed in the programme and its agenda and its history, and so was Jenny. So when I became editor, she knew that I recognised the heritage of the programme, which she did too.
What's the hierarchy? Who's in charge?
The editor is in charge and actually is also in charge of the presenter. So you're managing the presenter, managing the powers that be and what they think of it. And you're also managing a team of producers, which, as you can imagine, has diminished over the years with all the cuts that the BBC has had to make. I had a team of about 7 or 8 producers and some assistant producers and broadcast assistants to sort of back you up. Because when you're doing 5 live programmes Monday to Friday, and then the Saturday programme is a best of the week, which has to be recorded on the Friday to go out on the Saturday. We were working against the clock every morning because, you know, we would arrive in shortly after 6 and we were on air at 10. And it was fairly full on because Jenny needed to be briefed on each item. She needed to write her own question line from the notes and the structure that had been provided. And sometimes we'd pre-recorded items if people couldn't manage to get in live. So we were against the clock. Jenny was demanding, quite rightly. She needed to stick to a time schedule and get through it all and be in the studio ready to go on air by 10 o'clock. So if people weren't up to the mark, she didn't hesitate to tell them. And she had this sort of aura about to say, if you were briefing her, you went in and you sat on the chair, but you didn't talk to her. She talked to you and asked you questions, and you let her direct the conversation. Jenny used to present Monday to Thursday in London, and she would then go up to Manchester and she would present Woman's Hour from the regions on a Friday. Sometimes it came from Bristol, in which case Jenny wasn't presenting, and sometimes it came from Dublin, Cardiff. So that was the regional programme. But Jenny did Monday to Thursday with us in London. And the editor is in charge. And it's your vision what goes into the programme. Everybody has to contribute in terms of ideas. And the producers produce, there's a day producer, but they aren't responsible for all the items in the programme. Other producers will produce the items and they do briefing notes, which go to the presenter. So the night before, Jenny would get all her briefing notes for about 4 or 5 items in the programme. She always used to say that we gave her the wherewithal and she took it to air. That's not to say that she didn't have ideas, as you can imagine. She was a personality in her own right. After every programme, which was always live, afterwards we used to have a meeting, which I called the wash-up, and we'd discuss what went right and what went wrong and what we could have done differently, and Jenny came to that. A lot of ideas came from that meeting. Conversation would get going from that, and very often ideas would come out of what we'd been just chatting about. And then Jenny would contribute. She was very much her own boss when it got to going to air, but there was briefing and guidance and discussion as to direction and tone and that sort of thing. What we tried to do with the programme was put a sort of varied mix of items within. So not all news, not all medical. So we tried variety and texture to the programme. And I often used to think, well, people can wander off if they don't like one item, they're not interested in it, and they can come back and join in again for a change of item, different something. So we used to try very hard to sort of do amusing items that would make people smile or get them really engaged that way. And I remember we did an item, I don't know how it came up, but the discussion was about all female households and how the husbands or the partners survived with all females in the household, with the bathroom episode, you know, when they were banging on the door in the morning, and teenagers are notorious girls for occupying the bathroom for extended periods of time. I think then having ensuite bathrooms was perhaps not de rigueur as it is now. And we got Chris Patton on the programme. So there was no book to publish, but he just was intrigued by it. And he came to join in the discussion on the programme, which was great.
Jenny must have interviewed countless people over 33 years,
yeah,
both famous and unknown and specialists in their area, including politicians from this country, politicians from America, the famous interview with Hillary Clinton.
So Hillary Clinton was late, delayed by traffic, so you have to change the running order in that case. We happen to have Shirley Williams live as well. I think that phrase, that word live, is really weird, isn't it? But anyway, what she was there doing an item about her mother. And we often had her. She was always available, just delightful to have. And she did the interview. And then Hillary Clinton had arrived. And so you have to change guests over as Jenny says goodbye to one and introduces the other. And by mistake, Shirley left her handbag in the studio where she was, you know, to get out quickly. And Hillary Clinton walks in and was sitting in the interviewee's chair, as directed. No speaking, but gestures. And then all of a sudden she picks up this handbag and says to somebody, what should I do with this type thing, you know, miming. And of course, Jenny just loved moments like that. So she took it and said, Oh, Hillary Clinton has just arrived in the studio and she's holding up a handbag. I think it's Shirley Williams's, you know. So those are the sort of moments of broadcasting that just make a programme, actually, because they're spontaneous and they're real.
Yes.
Listeners love those.
Jenny was very much involved in some issues about women's health, the menopause and the HRT, and then she went public when she herself found she had breast cancer.
Yes, yes, and I was editor at that point too. So I was editor with her for 10 of the 33 years. Yes, I remember her ringing me later one afternoon and saying, I've been diagnosed with breast cancer. And of course, things like that have to be handled very carefully. First of all, she wanted to know, could I find out where she should go for treatment? So I put a call through to the major breast cancer charity. I couldn't reveal who it was, but, you know, I'm sure they understood perfectly. Then we had to be quite sensitive to, obviously, what Jenny wanted to do. But right from the start, she was going to make it public, and she duly did. And she went off air and had treatment and then came back more gradually and was very open about the whole experience. And actually, when we came round to Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which is sort of October time, Jenny was very up for it. We decided that we would do a whole month of items on the programme, not the whole programmes, but items dotted in every programme throughout the month on different aspects of living with, being diagnosed with breast cancer. And we got a huge response because the audience was incredibly important to Jenny and very loyal to her. So when we used to do live outside broadcasts, which we did on a regular basis, I don't think there's the finance to do them now, but we used to take programmes all over the place and have audiences, and they would love meeting Jenny. All the listeners came, and we always were guaranteed of a very enthusiastic reception. And it was a real delight to meet people and chat to them who were our regular listeners.
She was very concerned that she wanted to use the experience to help others.
Yep, absolutely. Yes. From that point of view, I think Woman's Hour had always had a pioneering sort of aspect. It's difficult to remember, but years ago, you didn't discuss cancer.
You certainly didn't discuss the menopause or anything like
that. No, what I call women's plumbing issues were very much swept under the carpet, and people weren't used to talking about their emotional reactions to experiences of life-threatening diagnoses and the trauma and bereavement. It wasn't something that was public. It was something very private that you didn't talk about. And Woman's Hour had always talked about things that weren't usually talked about on air and been very open. And Jenny championed that too, and particularly with her own breast cancer and her own menopause experience, yes.
And her 33 years would have been a huge transition during that time for the women, how women were perceived in society, because
totally.
You're going back to 87,
mm-hmm.
going to 2020. I mean, there's such a difference between
these
two. Yes. Woman's Hour then, Jenny bridged that gap, took it through, and was an ideal person in many ways for those sorts of issues.
Yes, yes. And she had been born and bred with Woman's Hour, as I was. We shared that sort of experience. You know, our earliest memories were doing quarter to two with your mum, listen with mother, and then at 2 o'clock, it was Woman's Hour. And I can remember my mother saying to me, "You be quiet now and sit on my lap, and I'm going to listen to my programme. You've had yours." And Jenny had exactly the same experience. And so we both had heard Marjorie Anderson presenting Woman's Hour as children, and we were reared on that sort of, you know, philosophy, basically, yes.
What would you say were the major strengths of Jenny Murray?
I think, I called her the shark, actually, as an interviewer, because if she had a politician or somebody in who she needed to call to account, she was very good at starting very gently with approachable questions that were fairly straightforward, and she would then build up, and like a shark, she would suddenly go in with a question. She was very good at listening, so if people gave her the opening, she'd be right in there with the question absolutely on the nub of it. And she did that with Edwina Curry. She put Edwina Curry on the spot by saying, "And what impact do you think your affair and the way you've written about it will have on John Major's wife, Norma?" And you could hear Edwina just take a breath. And the other thing that Jenny was very good at was being super sensitive with people who found it emotionally very difficult to tell their story, and they weren't used to broadcasting. And Jenny was an enabler as well. Again, she listened really carefully, but she also did it in a logical fashion so that the story unfolded in a way that listeners were caught up with and stayed with the interview. And if something was very moving, we would often get emails or or even letters before the days of emails, from listeners saying that they had been stopped in their tracks and they had to stop whatever they were doing and they had to listen to the interview. And she was very sensitive like that. She's very good at pacing, and she wasn't afraid of a moment of silence on radio, and she wasn't afraid of people showing their emotion, and she knew how to give them a moment in time so that they could just compose themselves sufficiently to go on. She was a wonderful woman, an icon of broadcasting, and the legend lives on.
Jill, thank you very much.
And now here's Charlotte from Guide Dogs.
Hello, this is Charlotte from Guide Dogs, back with another update from our Buddy Dog service. I've had a busy few weeks with some really nice stories to share. I spoke on the last update about Patrick, a Labrador Cross Golden Retriever who I just matched with an 8-year-old boy. I'm delighted to say that Patrick has now officially qualified as their buddy dog. The boy is getting out and about more and is keen to go on walks, which he was more reluctant to do before having Patrick. He has also taken Patrick into school to present him for show and tell, helping to educate other children on guide dogs and buddy dogs. One of the benefits of having a buddy dog is that it can allow children to speak positively about their vision loss with their peers, as well as opening up opportunities for interaction. After all, having a dog is a great way to start a conversation and break the ice. Patrick has built a fantastic bond with his match and even sleeps on the bottom of his bed. He will also wait by the back door every day for the boy and his brother to get home from school, and they have playtime in the garden every day. The family have taken Patrick on days out to the beach, and he's even been for a hike up a mountain. The family have said that even though it's only been a month, they cannot imagine life without Patrick, and that he has brought a huge amount of joy and companionship for their son. Seeing partnerships thrive is the best part of the job for me, so I was very pleased with this match. I will catch up with the family in 3 months' time to see how everything is going, and I'm sure they will have plenty of adventures to tell me about. On the topic of three-month updates, I caught up with Angel's family, who I matched back in December. Everything is going well, aside from the fact that she's taking a new liking to eating cowpats. Although our dogs come with a lot of training, they are still dogs and like to disgrace themselves on occasion. I advised avoiding rural walks for now and sticking to parks, and gave some advice on toothbrushing to help with her smelly breath. Despite her minor misbehaviours, on the whole, the partnership is going very well. Angel is a wonderful friend to their son and loves running around with him in the garden, and he loves throwing the ball for her when out on walks. Angel is a very affectionate girl and will curl up on the sofa with him when he's had a difficult day at school. Another successful partnership that I'm delighted to be supporting. This week, I've also assessed and accepted a Black Labrador Cross Golden Retriever called Celeste, who was deemed unsuitable to continue in guide dog training because she did not like wearing the guiding harness. This is a common reason why dogs end up coming into the buddy dog scheme rather than progressing as guides. Her trainer had done a lot of work on trying to get her used to it, but she had a long history of not liking wearing equipment since she was a tiny pup. She is otherwise a fantastic girl, calm, placid and gentle. So it was a very easy decision to accept her as a trainee buddy dog.
So that's it. We're at the end of our programme. It leaves me only to say a huge thanks to readers Catherine, Karen, Alison, Margaret, Ian and Clive. Thanks to Jill Burridge and Rob, who interviewed her. Many thanks to our contributors, Debbie and Charlotte. To the St Albans Times and the Hearts Advertiser for the kind permission to use their news items. And to Wardell and District News for supplying the audio-described TV listings, and to John and Angela, who gave us the radio listings. And thanks to the distribution team who send the drives out to you all. It's goodbye from me, and have a happy and peaceful week.
Leaving the scene. Ain't no use, baby. You're too doggone mean. Yes, I'm tired of paying dues, having the blues, getting bad news. Ain't no use. You
Ain't no use, Daddy, I'm putting you down. I'm gonna change my name. Things won't be the same, 'cause I'm tired of playing your game. Ain't no use, baby, I tell you, it ain't no use. I've tried all these years, Lord knows I've tried. Yes, and I cry deep down inside. But Daddy, why complain? It's all over, and you're to blame. Yeah, yeah. Ain't no use, baby, shed them tears. Ain't no use, baby, I cried for years, for too many years. You done had your fun. It's all over and done.